And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where we are still living in the 90s because 2020 is terrible. And in watching old Michael Jordan finals, I kept seeing a familiar face running around in 1992 and 1993 and then in the God disguised as Michael Jordan game. And I thought, I wonder if I could cajole this familiar face into coming on my podcast, because if he talks about the 80s and the 90s, I don't think he can even accidentally violate the NBA's tampering rules. And said guest agreed. So welcome, for the first time ever, the general manager of the 17-time world champion Boston Celtics, Mr. Danny Ainge. How are you?
Good, Zach. How are you?
I'm hanging in. That's all we can do is hang in.
Yeah, no, it's been good. Watching the Michael Jordan stuff has unfortunately relived some bad memories as I spent most of my career getting my butt kicked by Michael Jordan, but also some very, very fond memories as well.
Well, you didn't get your – I mean, he kicked everyone's butt, but we're going to talk about the fact that those – the two finals I mentioned were even closer than I remembered in rewatching them. But let's start with the 86 game, the 86 series where you guys sweep them 3-0. You're 40-1 at home. You're maybe the best team of all time. Scores 49 in game one, 63 in game two, in double overtime. Double overtime? Oh, my brain has turned to mush. Double overtime. I did not – was it known that you guys went golfing in between games one and two until this – before this documentary came out? Was that a thing that I just didn't – that was in the ether and I just didn't know?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned it before publicly, but – yeah, probably didn't get much play. I mean, I played golf with Michael a bunch of times, actually, over the years. And, I mean, that was what Michael, as you can tell by in the documentary, that's his escape. That's what he loves to do, is play golf. And I'm the same way. Mark Fancel and Mike Carey were friends of ours. Anyway, they put it together. Mark was a reporter out of Chicago and Mike from Boston. And the two of us played with Michael and myself that day. We had a great time. I think we played 36 holes at Framingham Country Club. And yeah, so Michael had 49 in game one and he had 52, I think, in game two in regulation. I'm not sure the loss on the golf course had much to do with Michael's 63 points in game two, because when he dropped me off that night, he said, be sure to let DJ know that I got something for him.
So he lost or you lost at golf?
Michael lost, yeah.
Michael lost. So did you guys know each other well enough to go golfing like on your own, or did it take like – or obviously these two other guys, Mark Fancel and Mike Carey, set it up. But did you know Michael well enough then that the two of you could have just gone golfing, or would that not have been a thing that happened in 1986?
Yeah, probably not. You know, I did not know. That was my introduction to Michael, other than playing against him on the court. But – that was my introduction to him on the golf course, and we had a great time. We hit it off. We had good matches. We were both pretty good players, and we both were very passionate about golf, and it was something that we loved. It was something that we loved to do. And in a precursor to the story, when Bill Fitch was coaching our team in, I think it was 1982, and Bird, McHale, Roby, and
Rick Roby, for people who don't know, was Larry Bird's. Was he Larry's closest friend on the team for a while?
Yeah,
definitely,
yeah.
One of his after hours buddies.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time with Larry off the court. But anyway, there was four of us. We went out and played, and Fitch told us after practice, he said, "You know, if you guys each going to be fined $500, and for playing golf yesterday on an off day." And there was silence, and no one said anything. And then about 10 seconds later, Bird says, "Well, boys, we better up the stakes tomorrow." it's always been fascinating to me that with all the things that I've been around in sports for 40 years, I played 18 years of professional sports, and for things for people to get upset about on an off day, riding in a golf cart up to your golf ball in the afternoon of a beautiful day, that's the least of the things that people should worry about players doing on their off day. I think it's a very relaxing, great time of the day.
golf never crossed the, I've only golfed like real golf maybe 20 times in my life, 15 times. I never crossed the barrier where it became relaxing for me. It was always frustrating. And by hole like 12, I would just be hungry and cranky. And I can't get through. It's 18 is too many holes. 36 is like unthinkable to me. I don't know how that's even possible.
Well, I during this lockout, I played 50 holes one day, and you know, it was just very relaxing, and it's not stressful for me. I mean, there are days where it can be very stressful, but I just enjoy it, and it's a great escape from reality, and it beats sitting in a movie theater.
Okay, so let's talk about the God Disguises Michael Jordan game. Mark Bartelstein, who you know, is one of the power agents in the NBA, probably represents a couple of your players. I don't know off the top of my head. He grew up a Bulls fan, and he remembers that game because it's Michael's second year. His first year, he's rookie of the year. He's a very good player right away. But in his memory as a Bulls fan in his 20s, Michael has a good rookie year, breaks his foot, misses essentially the entire 85-86 season, plays his little minutes limit and all that. Mark Bartelstein remembers thinking, Michael was good before the series. We kind of like, we didn't know he was going to become this. And that game, those two games back to back were like, whoa, this guy might be better than like a regular all-star player. So what did you guys know about Michael Jordan before those two games? Because again, he's on a minutes limit. He's barely played more than a year in the NBA. Did you guys as players already have a sense of, whoa, this guy, you know, won a championship in college. This guy could be special, or was he like a really good guy that you didn't know what he was going to be yet?
Yeah, I would say the latter. I say he was a really good player. We had a lot of respect for him, but did not know that he was going to, you know, we'd be talking about him 30 years later as one of the greatest players that's ever lived. I think that the 49 points got our attention, obviously, in game one, but we won the game by 20. And so, you know, we weren't going to make a lot of adjustments. It was like, if he gets 50 again, you know, we can still beat him. Let's just not let everybody else get going. And then he had 63, and I think that got our attention even more. But, I mean, game one was almost equally there. I mean, like I said, 52-49 was at regulation points, and he was equally spectacular in both games. But the fact that he almost beat us single-handedly in game two got our attention more, and we held him to 18 points in game three and won by 20. But he definitely earned the respect of not just the Boston Celtics at that time, but the entire NBA, I think, was awakened. And Bartelstein almost lost his family, his marriage, and everything else as a result.
I wrote about that. He skipped his own engagement party because he was at the bar. He couldn't take his eyes off the game. So I know we're going, this is a long, 86 is a long time ago. But I don't – like, during that game, I don't know – are there huddles that you remember where guys are just like, dude, what are we supposed to do? Is Casey Jones, the coach, is he's like, we might have to throw four guys at him? Are you guys almost like is part of you almost like chuckling on the bench because what you're seeing is so ridiculous? I don't know what you remember from this sort of heat of that. Or are you just like, we got to win? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there was any panic. We are a very confident group of players on that team. And, you know, the only thing I remember funny, first of all, DJ, I think, picked up his fourth foul, like really early in the third quarter. So at that point it was like, okay, well, our best defensive perimeter guy, you know, is going down. So there was a little bit of a concern at that moment, but the funniest thing was when Walton fouled out, he was screaming and cursing as he went to the bench and, you know, like, why don't the guards guard that blankety blank, you know, and why do we keep switching? And I think he picked up his last foul trying to guard Michael on a drive. And anyway, that was, I do remember laughing in that moment. It was kind of funny that, now you know how hard it is to guard him. So that's good for all of us to learn.
What I remember, so I was 8 years old, and my father was from New Hampshire, is from New Hampshire. He was a Celtics fan. So I grew up, you know, you guys were the team that I cheered for as a little kid. And the team that really sort of like 80s basketball, Celtics, Lakers, Rockets, Sixers, like that got me into sports more than baseball, more than anything. So 8-year-old me is watching this on, it was a Sunday afternoon. So I was up watching the game. It's not at nighttime. I can watch it. And I just remember being like literally frightened because in my head, you guys are, it's the only team that can touch you is the Lakers. I'm not even as an 8-year-old. I'm like, just get me to the finals. I'm not concerned about anything. And then this one guy, it was almost like a movie villain had invaded the game. And I'm sitting there 8 years old being like, I don't understand. How is this? Is one guy just going to beat this whole team? If to 8-year old me, if Michael Jordan could beat the 86 Celtics, like, aliens could invade Earth and wipe out civilization at any moment. Like it was that scary. Was there any fear that you guys would actually lose that game? And like, oh man, if it's 1-1 and this guy is unbelievable, like we could actually have a series here.
You know, I can only speak for myself, but I didn't sense any sort of fear. I mean, yeah, like we've been around, we're big boys. We've been to the finals the years before, won the championship in 84, 81. 85, we lost in the NBA Finals. I don't think that anybody was worried about us losing a series to the Chicago Bulls. So had we lost game two, we would have won game three and game four. I'm very confident of that.
Obviously, in the last couple episodes of The Last Dance, Michael's leadership style drew a lot of attention. The intimidation in practice, the trash talking, the sort of pathological competitiveness and the standards you had to meet. Was Larry similar to that? I mean, Larry obviously is a more low key guy, but he was also pathologically competitive. Was there any of that kind of atmosphere on your teams through him as the sort of the best player, the number one option kind of guy?
You know, I mean, Larry's were far and few between the chastising of the team publicly. He did a few times. Remember in 84, you know, he called us soft and whatever. But we all knew that. Like, it wasn't surprising. Or I remember one time we lost a game in Atlanta. And I think McHale had, this is a long time ago, but I think McHale had like 30 points going into the fourth quarter. And was giving Atlanta the business. But they threw the ball into Kevin in the first play of the fourth quarter. It got stolen. And then I think they came down and threw it into Kevin a second time. It got stolen. Anyway, Larry proceeded to shoot, I think, 1-for-11 in the fourth quarter the rest of that game and blamed Kevin for not being prepared to play a game seven. You know, like he can't win on the road in game seven or something. You know, something ridiculous like that. And it was – but, I mean, that's how he genuinely felt. That he's just not there. And, you know, through this documentary with Michael, you know, there's some code scenes that I think they did a really good job of still portraying. Like, I think that when Scotty didn't play game seven against the Pistons with the migraine, and, you know, Michael used a phrase, I learned that Scotty needed to believe that someone was on his side in a fight. And I think that that's kind of code for, you know, he had to evolve into that person to be able to take on the Boston Celtics or the Detroit Pistons or something like that. It's not a bad thing. It was just Michael was a few years ahead of Scotty, and Michael was the elite ultimate competitor. And I think Scotty was a beneficiary personally of playing next to Michael, not just by the things that Michael might have said to Scotty as much as what Scotty was able to witness as a teammate of Michael's. And that's what we all learned from Larry. Like, we didn't take things too personally, just like I don't believe those Bulls players did. But we just saw a guy that was passionate about winning and would do anything. So we're just going to ignore some of the things that he might say. Like, that has nothing to do with it because we see what the guy's doing on the court.
Larry, there are lots of stories, if you read all the books that have been written about the 80s Celtics, about that was a thing between Larry and Kevin McHale, right? Like, Larry just didn't think – Kevin McHale had a certain like nastiness and just all out. Like, Kevin McHale was kind of a normal guy, and Larry as a competitor was like at the next level of just trying to kill you. And I think there's a famous story of like Larry broke like Kevin McHale maybe broke the franchise scoring record, had a shot to get 50 in a game and didn't go at it. And Larry was like, how can you not keep going for the record? And then the next game he scores 50, he breaks the record or something. But that, how much of that was a real dynamic that Larry just kind of thought Kevin's a great player. Obviously they won multiple, you know, three titles together, but didn't have like the same pathological fire.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that they're completely different people. And I, just like Michael and Scotty, I think you can draw a parallel in that they didn't see the world the same way. They didn't, you know, approach the game or approach life or anything the same way. And I think that there are some people that are just, you know, frustrated that they don't have this same competitive drive and fire. You know, I coached Jason Kidd early in his career, and, you know, he had a similar issue sometimes that guys just aren't doing the right things or trying as hard as him. And, you know, you could look at his eyes in the fourth quarter of a game and just see an assassin. And I loved that about Jason, but, you know, he, at the same time, I had to talk to him after every game on the way to the locker room in Phoenix because he may, like, go nuts on somebody in the locker room after the game. And so it was just, but his teammates loved him and adored him because, like, the guy was all about winning, and there wasn't any doubt about that. And I think the same thing with Michael and Larry. And, yeah, there's differences between players, and but I think Larry grew to really respect Kevin. It just wasn't always that way. I mean, I was there. My first 8 years were, you know, 1 year behind Kevin coming into the league and 2 years behind Larry. So oftentimes Larry would say, Danny, go tell Kevin this. Or Kevin would come to me and say, Danny, go tell Larry this. And so I was like in between. These are like my two big brothers. And I'm like trying to, but they didn't communicate as well. At the same time, I think that as time grew on, they had an amazing mutual respect. And personally, I think the same thing happened with Scotty and Michael as well.
Although it is funny, I don't know if you noticed this. I went back and watched it the other day. When they bring up the migraine game, I feel so bad calling it the migraine game. The game in which Scottie Pippen had a migraine, game 7 against the Pistons, they say the word migraine, and Michael's on the camera, and Michael has this little smirk go across his face. Like, he still kind of doesn't believe that Scottie had a migraine, or doesn't really believe that a migraine would ever keep him from being at his competitive game. Like, I go back and watch it. There's a little smirk that comes across Michael's face. Like,
I saw it. I saw it too. That's what I'm saying. That's the code. The Michael smirk and the, you know, then, you know, I'm saying, you know, Scotty needed to know that he had someone to fight with him. And so, you know, like it was like those code things were real. And I think that they were blown. Michael probably blew them out of proportion as a player in that moment. But over time, over history, he realizes Scotty was a gamer. He was a great player. He was so fortunate to play with him. But back in the moment, I guarantee you Michael had a problem with it.
Interesting. Let's flash forward to 92 because a lot of stuff happens, and then you face Michael in the finals with the Portland Trail Blazers, and the Blazers have come off a finals loss to the Pistons in 90, and then they don't make the finals in 91, which is an underrated kind of franchise disappointment, I think, for them, for the Lakers to advance past them. And you go into that finals. And now at that point, I'm 14 years old. I'm like a full-on nerd sports fan. The Clyde Michael thing was real. At least in the media, it was real. At least with, like, my friends at lunchtime in high school, that was a real thing. Like, is Clyde threatening Michael's status? I wonder, inside your team, was it something that people were aware of the noise, and was there any fear that Michael was also aware of the noise and it could get bad?
You know, I hate to admit this, but, you know, going into that season, like, 91 was a very big – you're right about that. That was a big disappointment for us in Portland. We thought we should have beat the Lakers and been in the finals that year. Thought we were the better team. Lakers beat us, and 92 was a very focused year for that Blazer team. And Clyde had a spectacular season, was an incredible player, passer, much better passer than people give him credit for, a better teammate, just like Clyde was a joy to play with. And He was an amazing player. He wasn't Michael. Like, he's guilty of not being Michael, because right. when all that talk started going, and you know how the buildup gets in the NBA Finals, everybody's all, you know, making everything a big story, but that was the story. Like, Clyde versus Michael. And I did not like that. I felt like our team versus their team had a chance, but I, you know, like, Michael, by that time, in my mind, is the best player in the league, and there is not a dispute as to who's a better player between Michael and Clyde. And Clyde was good, great. Like, he was the second or third best player in the NBA at that moment. So no knock on Clyde, that Michael was in a different class. And I just, knowing Michael like I did, I was worried about that. I was worried about that. And the same back in 1993, the next year, you know, Charles wins the MVP, which he deserved at that time. I mean, Charles had a great year. Phoenix, that was a great story. I'm sure a lot of fans got tired of voting for Michael every year. And you know, but I was worried about that motivation for Michael as well.
So I rewatched, I've been living in the 90s. So I rewatched the Shrug game, which is game one of the 1992 finals. And I have to say, watching it whatever years later, I was a little disappointed. Because, like, really what happened in the Shrug game, where Michael hit six threes in the first half, which is a finals record, and I think the previous record was like four. Like, he just shattered the record. Like, you guys just didn't guard Michael from three because he didn't take threes, and like, nobody took threes. And so Michael just decided, I guess I'm just going to shoot these wide open looks. So I don't know. Do you remember being like, on the bench, commercial breaks, being like, this is weird. Do we need to actually address? Is this just random? Is he going to stop shooting? It was a strange game in retrospect.
Well, I mean, I think going into that series, I don't know how many he made, but I'm guessing 30 threes the entire season.
27.
Okay, 27 threes the entire season. So, you know, Michael was unguardable getting to the rim. He had his hand size, his coordination, his ability to use both hands. He slithered through and in and around multiple people coming after him. It was all about keeping him off the line and keeping him out of the paint. So when Michael's shooting threes and there's guys like Cliff Robinson, myself, Clyde Drexler, like giving him room, that just means that's what we wanted him to do.
No, that's the game plan. It just in my head, I had built it up as this like mythical accomplishment of superhuman ability, and all he did was take wide open threes.
Right, but when you add a three-point shot, I mean, it's a little bit like LeBron James that we've seen. And, you know, when LeBron can make his little step back going left three-point jump shot, like, how do you guard him? They just become completely unguardable. And Michael, when he's making threes, it's a little bit of a frustration, because now what do? You can't take the three away and open up the very best part of his game, the game that has been part of his career and everything else. So that six threes in the first half was surprising. You know, I don't know if he even keeps shooting threes if he doesn't make, you know, three or four in a row right there. I'm not even sure he even continues to attempt them. If he misses one or two, he probably would just keep trying to get to the rim. So, I mean, you got to tip your hat to him. I think it's a good lesson that in evaluating eras, even though Michael wasn't a three-point shooter in his day, if Michael grew up in the game today, I think we can all acknowledge that he was a great shooter and he would have been one of the best three-point shooters in the game.
In game two of that series, which is a monumental win, really, for the Portland Trail Blazers, you guys are down like 10 with a few minutes left to go. Clyde fouls out, and you guys come back and force overtime. Michael misses a potential game winner at the buzzer. You win in overtime by, like, running away. There's a moment where you're bringing the ball up, and Bobby Hansen, this was the Bobby Hansen series, unfortunately for you guys, Bobby Hansen goes under a screen against you from, like, 25 feet out, and you just jack a three off the dribble. And it was like, watching it now, it's like an alien from 2020 got dropped into an NBA game, and like, nobody took off the dribble threes. But that game, those Portland teams, I think, are kind of remembered as, you know, didn't quite have the gumption to do it, like, didn't get over the hump. You don't win that game in Chicago if you're not a tough team. That's with Clyde Drexler fouled out on the road, down 1-0 against the best player in the world. I don't know what your memories are of that win. Did you guys never lose faith in that game? But that's a gritty, gritty win.
Yeah, I remember that game well. I think that I played really well coming in for Clyde late in that game.
You did.
And in overtime. And I remember that being a very big win for us. And the team did have a lot of guts. And, you know, that team got criticized a lot for shot selection and, you know, weren't smart. And, you know, I learned from Rick Adelman, who I thought did a fantastic job with that group of guys. And Adelman told me in training camp, my first year in Phoenix or in Portland, he said, "You got to take that shot, Ainge." When I was about 5 feet behind the 3-point line one day. And I said, "Seriously?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I would rather have you take that shot and let Clyde, Jerome, and Buck chase it down than you throw the ball to one of them on the post. Like, take the chance of making the shot because they're going to get it off the rebound." And I remember about it took – I thought that was kind of silly advice at first, but maybe 20, 25 games into the season, I went, there's a method to this. Some of the shots that we're taking, I understand why the outside world says, wow, that's not such a – that's a third – it's almost like shooting two for ones on some possessions because our guy, we are such a good offensive rebounding team and Duckworth and Cliff and, you know, added to that as well. So, that was a big win. Game two was huge.
Cliff Robinson, by the way, I think is one of the all-time would have been better 20 years later. Play. I mean, he was good. Cliff Robinson was really good. He has, like, if you look at his career, that's like, dude, this guy scored, like, over 15,000 points. Like a real, but when you guys played him at the five, like Buck Williams out, Kevin Duckworth out, put Jerome Kersey at the four, Cliff Robinson at the five, that's a lineup in 1992 where you're like, that is a – like Cliff Robinson is a stretch five would be a huge problem today.
No question. Well, I did – I played Cliff as a stretch five when I coached him in Phoenix in the late 90s. He was playing my stretch five. I had Hot Rod Williams and Cliff Robinson were my centers. And but Cliff was a stretch five in the late 90s.
The Portland series in 92 against the Bulls is the one that is most different looking at it now than it felt to me in my memory. In my memory, it's just another one of the finals that was never really in jeopardy for the Bulls. It's like they're always up 3-1. It's always sort of like, you know, it's almost – it's anticlimactic when they win. And then I rewatch them like, man, it was 2-2 with Game 5 in Portland. Now, we can talk about Game 5. So the Bulls are facing a Game 5 on the road, and they're going to go down 3-2 if they lose. And you guys won Game 4 with, like, an astonishingly good defensive performance against the Bulls. Game 5 was rough. We can talk about what happened in Game 5 if you want. But after Game 4, did you guys think – see, Michael is just this mythical figure. And to fans and regular people, the Bulls were just unbeatable. But 2-2, did you guys think, yeah, we have a handle on this. We know how to beat this team. We can win.
You know, I guess the best analogy I can think of with Zach is like – it's like golf. I mean, I often play golf with guys that I know are better players than me. But still, in my naive mind, I believe that I'm winning, even though the odds may be 1-10, 2-10, 4-10. I don't know what the odds are. And I don't know what we thought the odds were against. But I do believe that we thought we had a chance to beat Chicago, especially going into Game 5. And, I mean, I think everybody in that situation believes, like, we have a chance. I think that Michael, I mean, because he always wins that game, and he did it so many times in his career. As you look back over years, you go, "Yeah, I'm sure everybody thought they were going to win, but like Michael comes out the winner every time in those most important games." And so everybody loses in six or loses in game seven, and he comes away winning all those games.
That game five. They come that might be, it reminded me. Remember the Miami Indiana in LeBron's second year in Miami. The Heat are down 2-1. Bosch is hurt, and the game is in Indiana. It's game four, and Wade and LeBron have like one of those games where they're just in sync. Like LeBron's hitting him on cuts. They combine for 70, I think, in that game. Scotty and Michael had that game in game five in Portland. I don't know if you remember that, but they come out, they combine, I think Michael has 46, Scotty has 24 and misses a triple double by one assist. And they're just like hitting each other with passes defensively. They like multiple fast breaks by Portland. They break up. It was to me one of their finest performances together. And I don't know if you remember feeling like, man, that's a damn impressive team, or that game is just a blur for you. But look, rewatching it, I'm like, those guys came out and they're like, we're not losing this game.
Yeah. I mean, listen, those guys are, you know, two of the top 20 players of all time. And in the prime of their careers, Scotty was the third, I think second or third in voting the next year, I think, when Michael left playing.
94.
I guess that was 2 years later.
Yeah, 2 years later. He was third.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, we're talking about two of the greatest players that have ever played the game. So it wasn't a shock. But, you know, when that series was over, I think that I did feel like, you know, we got beat by the better team. It wasn't as devastating as it was losing in 91 to the Lakers, where we thought we were better. It wasn't as devastating as in Phoenix when we lost to the Bulls in the finals. But this one, Michael, and I think game five was probably the deciding factor. But it just felt like at that point and the rest of that series that the best team won. And it was tip your hat to Michael and Scotty. They're amazing.
If people want to go back and see two athletic two-way wing players, two of the best, maybe the best player ever, and certainly, as you said, a top 20 player, at the absolute apex of their game, both individually and working together, watch the first quarter of that game five in the 92 finals, because they come out and they're like, Terry Porter, you're not going anywhere. Clyde, you're not getting away from us, and they're forcing turnovers. It's crazy. Then the next year you go to Phoenix and you get to see Michael again in the finals. And you get, again, as you said, have a player who's being billed as like, is this guy as good as Michael? You know, Charles is the MVP. You guys have home court. And that was a weird series where like the road team won all but one game in the series, I think. But it sounds like you guys thought, I mean, I think you won 63 games that year and you had the MVP. It sounds like you guys thought, yeah, we can beat them. We're not afraid of that team.
No, I think we thought we could beat them. And, you know, but you need your best players playing really well in every game in order to beat that Bulls team. We knew that everybody needed to step up and play their best. And Michael was a tough matchup for us. You know, KJ was a really good defender but was small. And Marley was a really good defender but just not as quick and as athletic. And so we just didn't have that guy that could just match up with Michael and, you know, put some breaks on him, like a Gary Payton or somebody who did it a couple of years later. But, you know, I think that it was a team that we thought that we were going to play better. But I say that in that series, as I remember it, I haven't gone back and looked at it, but the hardest thing playing against Chicago had nothing to do with the triangle offense. It had to do with scoring on them. They were so dominant in the last 5 minutes of games defensively, it was really hard to get a quality look on them. And I remember us having some open looks down the stretch of games, even in that game six where Paxson hits the three to beat us, the shots were there. It wasn't just their defense, but we had some open looks and couldn't make them. But Chicago was very smart defensively, and they dictated who they wanted to let shoot.
You are correct in remembering the stretch run of game six. So I just watched that today, actually. So I'll tell you what happened. You guys are up 98-94. And you're right that Chicago's defense, Cartwright told me we were often a better defensive team than offensive team. He told me that for a story. But their offense failed in that fourth quarter. You guys started that fourth quarter down by six or seven and end up taking a 98-94 lead with under a minute to go, and you have the ball. You come curling off a screen for like a long two, and they converge on you, and you kick to Frank Johnson, who has 15 feet of space for like a 17-foot jumper. And in that moment with like 38 seconds left in the game, you freeze life at that moment when that ball is in midair, and you're thinking, this is going to game seven in Phoenix because they're about to go up by six. Frank Johnson could never get a better look than that in his life. The Bulls rebound that shot. He misses. The Bulls rebound it. Do you remember what happens after the Bulls rebound it?
Yeah, I do remember. I mean, like, first of all, Frank was fourth quarter Frank. That was just
yes, that's what they all called during him the year.
That sucker was on the court and there in that moment because he made so many big shots for us that season. And Frank did miss that open jumper, and Michael got the ball and went coast to coast and scored like within 5 seconds after getting the defensive rebound. And that was a huge, huge play.
And I will tell you this, the guy chasing Michael on his hip all the way up and down the court until about the 3-point line was you. And he just was a little bit inside you. Like, you weren't going to stop him, but you were right stride for stride with him as best you could.
Yeah, no, that was, I remember that play very, I mean, that lay-in was, you know, that lay-in and then Paxson three was, you know, those were in my mind for 3 months. I did not sleep well in the next 3 months after that game.
I have to say, in rewatching some of these old finals games, Michael had a really smart sense of time. And, like, you know, every game now in the NBA you hear, oh, 2-for-1, they didn't get the 2-for-1, or they got the 2-for-1, they preserved the 2-for-1. Michael, down the stretch of these finals games, was always trying to go early when he could, and the Bulls need another possession. He had a very good – and that was another example of it. And then the pack – can you close your eyes and see the Paxson play, the whole play in your head? Can you tell it without looking?
I remember that – we took a chance, or we went for a steal, and there was penetration by Scotty.
By Scotty.
Yeah, Scotty penetrated in, and I had Paxson. And coming out of the timeout, I'm yelling at my team and the team huddle, no threes. No threes. I mean, I must have said it 10 times.
Because you're up two. So at the worst, we got to go to overtime or get the ball back. Right.
And so I think it was Charles Mida who went for the steal, doesn't get it. Scotty drives straight to the basket and hits Horace. And when he threw it to Horace, I never imagined that Horace was going to hot potato the ball out to Pax. I thought Horace was going to go up for a dunk. I thought maybe I could get it from behind or foul him hard. But, I mean, he got rid of that ball so quick, and I was just stuck in the middle of it, and there I left John Paxson open. I mean, I played against Pax my whole career, and one thing I know about Pax is I did not think that shot was going to miss. And to his credit, he knocked a big shot down, and you know, that was a very painful loss.
It's an interesting play because
thanks for bringing up that memory.
Look, this is what happens when you have Michael Jordan's contemporaries on. They just have to talk about what it was like to lose to Michael Jordan. There's no other subject matter. I mean, we could talk about COVID-19 if you want. It's much less, you know, fun. But you're right. So Michael's not really involved in that play at all. He passes it off to Scotty, and Charles, because Scotty plays the four a lot down the stretch of that game. So Charles is guarding him, and Charles tries for the steal, doesn't get it, and is lunging toward half court, and Scotty immediately spins and beelines for the rim, drops it off to Horace in the dunker spot, and at that point you have no choice because Horace is going to dunk the ball. So you run at Horace, and I've always said it's the most underrated part of the play. Horace throws this crazy spinning back away from the hoop pass on the button to Paxson for the winning shot, and like, you don't think of Horace Grant as a passer. You think of him as a rugged rebounder, interior scorer, a little bit mid-range jumper, great defender. That is a really, really good pass, and it's kind of like everyone remembers the Paxson shot, but I'll bet you if you polled like 100 NBA fans, they would think that Michael like drew a double team and passed it to Paxson, and it's Scotty to Horace and a crazy backward pass to Paxson. That you're right, you just don't think that's the way that play is going to unfold.
No, I mean, you know, and like I said, I knew coming out we didn't want to give up a three, but your instincts just take over in those moments of the game. And it was a great pass, no question about it. And that wasn't in Horace's nature. I hadn't seen him make great passes like that most of his career, but he sure did at that time.
So in the documentary, when they bring up that Jordan had heard that Jerry Krause, his GM/nemesis, loved Dan Majerle and was obsessed with Dan Majerle. And that was like part of Michael's motivation for trying to win that finals and go at Dan Majerle. Did you just sort of like, did you know that? Or was it, did you text Dan Majerle? I don't know if you have Dan Marley's number. Did all the old Suns sort of start talking like, man, no wonder this guy had the greatest. I mean, it might be the greatest finals of all time, individually, Michael's 93 finals.
I think the whole story about Michael's motivation is a little bit overrated in this documentary. But other than the fact that if it wasn't Dan Majerle, it was something else. If it wasn't Charles Barkley, it was Dan Majerle. If it wasn't Dan Majerle, it was Kevin Johnson. If it wasn't Kevin Johnson, it was Danny Ainge. It was, you know, Oliver Miller. I mean, Paul Westphal could like pass by him at dinner and that might, I mean, all of that stuff is just like, that's who Michael is. It's just, it doesn't have anything to do with Dan Majerle, but I mean, Michael probably, he just found a way to invent a competitive edge to keep him at that competitive edge and motivated to win.
I'll tell you, Barkley, rewatching 93 Barkley, there was just nothing anybody could do with that guy. Like, Horace Grant is he an all defensive level player? I mean, he's very good. And it's like automatic crisis double team when Charles gets the ball in the post against Horace Grant. Like, and to the point that they bring Scott Williams in crunch time for a little X, but like, Charles was just on another level that season. And I don't know if when Charles was in shape and like really playing, that dude was an absolute monster. And that season, like the Bulls there was nothing you could do with him in the post. It was really, you know, astonishing how powerful and athletic he was.
I think Charles is one of the most underrated players in the history of our game. I mean, playing with Charles in Phoenix, I mean, first of all, the guy made me laugh, genuinely laugh every single day. It was such a joy to play with him. And, you know, he was far from perfect, but he was so gifted. And, you know, 93 was that special year where he wins MVP. And personally, I think it had something to do with playing in the Dream Team in 92, realizing, like, I am as good as every one of these players. And he was also in the best shape, I think, that ever in his career at that moment, because he had played during the summer and spent so much time with the top players in the world. And so, but he was a joy to play with. He was great. I mean, his physical tools were as good as any power forward that's ever played.
And just to put a bow on the 93 finals, I mean, I really had forgotten the Frank Johnson jumper. Then you guys get the ball back. You're still up two, 98-96. And Frank Johnson doesn't want to shoot. Almost the same shot materializes for him twice on the next possession. He doesn't take it. Kicks to Majerle on the baseline. Marley's wide open. Badly misses a long two. Like, I had just forgotten. I knew about the Paxson shot, obviously, so I knew you guys were close to forcing in Game 7. But I really forgot how close that was to, okay, it's Game 7 in Phoenix. Like, anything. Like, it was really, you guys should have won the game, frankly. I mean, you should have won the game.
Now, and those open shots came as a result of them taking the ball out of Charles' hands. Is that right?
That's what, yeah, I remember. Yeah, Charles was automatic double team. Automatic.
Yeah, Charles just had to kick it out, and we had to make an open shot. They were forcing us to just make an open shot, and we couldn't make one.
And it's really, I mean, you watch these old games. No one is spacing to the three-point arc. Like, not even guys you think of as shooters. Like, Kevin Johnson is spacing to, like, 19 feet away for these kick-out passes from Charles. It's like, why is the line even there? No one is – there's, like, one guy on the floor that's even bothering with it. It's really crazy how bad the spacing was.
Yeah, it was a different time, and the percentage of shot was more important than the factor of the third point. And so I just think that yeah, KJ, it took a while. KJ, it wasn't until, like, I coached KJ, actually, that he started shooting threes, and he started making them and became a very good three-point shooter in the NBA. And then just like so many guys growing up without the three-point line, it just took time for us to evolve into recognizing the importance of that shot.
By the way, at some point in the 92 finals, you make a three, and Marv Albert says Danny Ainge has moved in to second all-time in NBA playoff made threes. I'll give you three guesses. Who do you think was ahead of you in 1992 for all-time playoff made threes?
Was it Bird?
Nope. This is according to Marv Albert. I have not fact-checked Marv Albert's exact to the day rankings of all time. I assume he's right.
Wow.
I'll give you a hint. It's somebody you faced in multiple finals.
Right. I was going to say Michael Cooper.
That's who it was. Michael Cooper was number one all time in playoff made threes. I mean, I guess it makes sense because the three only came in 79-80, but like Michael Cooper in 92 is still like number one all time. Anyway.
Right.
Speaking of underrated players, I agree with you. Charles is underrated. We just did this top 74 all time players at ESPN.com. KG came 20th. Now, I have.
Wait, you did top how many? 74?
74. I think, okay. this is the 74th season. I don't know why we did 74. KG came 20th. Now, my gut reaction to that was that's too low. I haven't researched enough to know who I would leap him over. Dirk is right in front of him. Julius Erving is nearby. Moses Malone is nearby. But I do think KG is closer to like 12th than he is to 25th. And I fear that he is going to go down as one of the most underrated players of all time because of how he sort of languished in Minnesota. Prime KG was, 25, 10, and 5, 23, 10, and 5, legitimately defending 1 to 5. KG has a case as the greatest defensive player of all time. I don't know where you would rank him, but I think the what if of like if you flipped where they got drafted between Duncan and Garnett, I would love to see how their careers had played out. I mean, Tim is better than Garnett, ranks higher than Garnett. But if Garnett had gotten drafted to the Spurs, I would love with their front office and how they drafted afterwards. I just think he might be the all-time victim of NBA circumstance.
Well, I mean, there was a time when him and Marbury were together. It looked like those guys were going to be, a franchise duo for years and years to come when they were young in Minnesota. So it fell apart there when Steph ended up leaving. But, KG was, such a joy to be around. I mean, forget about the numbers. I think the numbers, when he was in Boston, he certainly wasn't at his peak. And yet he changed our culture single-handedly. I mean, he changed the culture because he gave so much confidence to everybody else. He was so unselfish. It was all about winning, and his versatility, his ability to guard 1 through 5, his ability to score if you needed him to score, and his unwillingness or his willingness, I should say, to share the ball with Paul and Ray and let Rondo have the ball in his hands a lot. I mean, KG was a consummate team player, and I think he's up there when it comes to top defensive players of all time. I think I would have to put, you're too young to remember watching Bill Russell play, but I would say Bill Russell was the best defensive player of all time, and KG is in the running for number two.
Were you at the game, I believe it was in Utah, in 2009 when he hurt his knee? Or he hurt his shin. I don't remember exactly what. He hurt some tendon, but he went up for an alley-oop and your season kind of went away with his landing. Were you at that game and how quickly did you know? People forget that team started something crazy, like 27-2, just rampaging, looking at a back-to-back title. How quickly did you know, this is going to be a before and after moment for us?
Yeah, I didn't know. I knew that if KG got hurt and, but I did not think that KG would be out for a long period of time. Matter of fact, we did start out 27-2. I thought that 2009 was every bit as good as 2018, if not better. And, we were plugging along great. And when KG went down, I wasn't that worried at the moment. The doctors gave me some assurance that they thought that, he'd be back. Might be a couple weeks, might be 4 weeks, but that, he would return that season and then we could hold down the fort, with Scalabrine and Leon Poe and, Big Baby and, we could get by. And we did get by for a while, but, without KG, obviously our championship hopes went down the tubes.
What's your best KG story? He's an all-time NBA character. I ask everyone who's ever crossed paths with KG that comes on this podcast, I ask, just give me one window into what made this dude tick or what made him a teammate or what just made him a presence where you watched or listened to him and were like, this guy is just a different kind of cat.
So Zach, I can't give you the one that comes to my mind, but there's so many funny ones, but you know, I can't really say them publicly, but maybe I can tell you privately someday. I can't say it on your show, but KG was just, you know, he was such a character. You probably heard this story, but one where he had me laughing so hard was Doc would always try to get him. Doc would always initiate a rookie in training camp by saying, "Hey, go sub for KG in the scrimmage." And I mean, KG would just tear their head off. Like, get off the court, rookie. Don't ever come and sub for me. And, you know, and so it was just a rookie orientation thing that they had to go through. It was like trying to sub for KG. They only had to do it once and they would never try it again. But Doc KG was at the stage where Doc felt like we need to manage his practice minutes. So he would try to convince KG constantly to go, come sit down and rest. And KG just would not. If we're practice is going on, especially if we're scrimmaging, like I'm playing. And so Doc one time forced KG out. KG, get off the court. Stood out, stopped the play, get out. So KG went onto the other court and started running wind sprints. But I was sitting up in my office looking down at the whole scenario, and I was just dying laughing. I mean, the guy made me laugh all the time, too. It was, you know, but it was genuine with him. It wasn't fake. It was like that's who he was. He wanted to practice. He felt like he needed to be the guy in practice.
Let's talk a little bit about 2020, because you are the general manager of a team that has playoff hopes and hopes to go deep into the playoffs. The answer to all of these questions is I don't know. So I'm not going to bother asking you, like, are we going to return to play this and that? I will ask you this. Have you had any players, don't name them, but have you had any players express concern to you or Brad that you've heard of I'm a little scared. I'm a little scared about what playing would look like, or I'm a little scared of, like, is it a good idea for us to play? Or are all your guys just like, tell me when we can open the facility, I'm ready to play games?
I haven't had anybody share concern just because we're not close to the time. So our next phase in Massachusetts has been one of the slowest at opening things up. And so our next phase is we'll open up our facility. We're hoping to do it next week. And it's one-on-one work, one coach, one player, coaches with masks and gloves, players in the gym. Disinfect the gym. So I think that I don't think anybody's afraid of that.
Right.
If I said we're 2 or 3 weeks away from playing, I'm sure there would be some players that would have some trepidation, but I think everybody's just really anxious to play right now. That's what I think.
Would you, if the NBA does this bubble thing in Disney World or whatever, would you go?
Sure.
Okay. I don't think I want to go, but you know, we'll see what the world looks like.
I don't know if I want to go either. I don't know where I'm going to sit. I don't know if I'm going to be in the gym, if I'm going to be watching it on TV. I don't know. I'm not really afraid, but I don't think that that's in our best interest at this moment. I'm hoping that in the next 2 months we have things that make it easier and more comfortable. So I'm confident that we will. I hope we will.
Do you want to play the season? Have you already mentally moved on to the off season? We're all in a weird headspace right now. Like, do you still think of the 2020 Celtics? Like, yeah, I want to see what this can do, what this team can do. Or are you just like, it's cleaner if we go on? Do you want to play as the GM? I assume you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are the times that guys play for, and it's almost like we just played 60 games and it doesn't mean anything. So I think that I would like to finish the season, and I think most of the players, if not all the players, would like to finish the season and, you know, move on the next year whenever. But I think from the management standpoint, yes, we got to, like, manage the draft, manage free agency. That means pushing the season back is going to make those windows much, much smaller at different times and much more complicated, but we're trying to do all we can right now. I mean, I got a lot of time on my hands, and so we're trying to be as prepared as we possibly can.
How many salary cap and luxury tax projections do you have right now? Do you have zero because you're just like, I give up, or do you have like 100?
I told Z, I don't even want to see those. Like, it does me no good right now. Like, that's not part of the equation. We're just talking players, evaluation, and we'll talk about that because nobody knows the answer to that. I mean, those things are changing month by month also. So we'll see if we even come back to play. Those numbers could look better. And I'm just hoping that we can go out and play. I mean, listen, it's fun watching The Last Dance. It's fun watching, some old Celtics games, but I'm like way over that now. I'm ready for the real stuff. And even some pro golf to get back and pro baseball. Like I'm really itching for college football, NFL. So I hope we can find some solutions to the crisis that we're facing.
One last dance question I forgot to ask you. They made a big deal out of the Pistons walking off the court when the Bulls finally beat them in 1991. And Isaiah says, well, you know, Bill Laimbeer and I said to ourselves, let's pass the torch to Chicago the way Boston passed it to us in 1988. And said, you know, if you watch the film, Larry Bird walks off the floor. Some of the Celtics walk off the floor. And I went back and watched it, and Isaiah's right. Some of you guys walk off the floor while Adrian Dantley is at the foul line. I said on my podcast already, I think the circumstances are a little bit different because you guys are in Detroit. The home crowd is already celebrating. There's already been some fans and photographers storming the floor to the point that the PA addresser, the PA announcer says, you know, please, the game's not over. People, sit in your seats. But he drew an equivalent. So I want to ask you, did you guys talk about it? Walking off? Do you even remember walking off? Do you feel that was a fair comparison for him to make?
I don't think it's a fair comparison because there was no plan. We had never done that before to any team. Yeah, we had a good rivalry with Detroit. But, I mean, Detroit had earned our respect. We were more than fortunate to beat Detroit in 87. And then, you know, for them to win in 88 was probably – they were justified. They were a better team. And I don't remember having any hatred toward them. We weren't going to say, you know, wish them goodwill. I think it had simply to do, there was such a long walk back to the tunnel in Detroit. And we left before the buzzer sounded just for our own safety. And the one guy that was still on the court was Kevin. And Kevin did stop and talk to Isaiah. And, you know, so there wasn't a coordinated effort in any way, shape, or form other than the safety of the players. Unlike Detroit, who, like, game plans to, you know, snub the Bulls as they walked by him for whatever reason. And, you know, I don't think it was close to being the same.
No, the hostility between you guys and Laimbeer, particularly Larry and Laimbeer, that was real. So Mike, if you see Laimbeer in like life right now, would you talk to him or do you guys still, is Laimbeer still persona non grata for all the 80 Celtics?
I mean, listen, he was tough to play against in that regard, but I get a kick out of Bill, and I would talk to Bill. I have run into Bill over the years, and I have talked with him. So yeah, I don't really hold any grudges against guys that we played against. I respected the Pistons then, and I respect him even more now.
By the way, Bill Laimbeer, 3-time NBA All-Star. The average fan just thinks he's a bully that hit people. He's a 3-time All-Star. The Bad Boys were awesome. They had one team that made the finals. I had our stats guys look this up. 7 players averaged double digits. You know how rare that is? I think they're like one of 3 teams that have ever made the finals with 7 guys averaging double digits. They were a deep, nasty team. That is, I think, is actually because they're the gap team between Magic, Bird, and Michael, that they've kind of become historically underrated, and their run was a little, you know, they came very close to three-peating. It almost won the 88 finals. That was a damn good team. Forget the violence, forget the bullying, forget all the, you know, whatever. Like, that was just a straight up good, deep basketball team.
No question. You know, and so we grew up in an era, as you said, there wasn't a lot of spacing, and, but there were some dominant bigs in that era. And, you know, double teaming was a big deal. Started out where you double team the post and you'd rotate 2 guys. Then it evolved into double teaming in the post and rotate 3 players out. And the Detroit made it a 5-man rotation. When they had Sally and Rodman in at the 4 and the 5, I mean, they just rotated all. And that was the first time we saw 5 guys that could play all five positions defensively on the court. And it changed the game defensively. And you got to give them a lot of credit. I mean, Rodman and Sally were enormous off the bench and gave them amazing versatility defensively. And adding that to the great Dumars and Benny Johnson and Isaiah Thomas, and they're amazing. And Adrian Dantley and Mark Aguirre, they did have a very, very big team. And James Edwards, they had a lot of scoring on that team as well.
Last question that I have to ask you, and then I will let you go. When did you know, and why did you know, that you wanted to trade down in the 2018 draft? Was it 2018, maybe 2017 draft? Trade down from 1 to 3. How did you know, and when did you know?
That's a question I can't answer honestly. I can't answer that question for lots of different reasons, but
it's 2017.
But I do think that there was a time for lots of different reasons that we had our eyes set on Jason Tatum. And we were very confident that Philly and was taking Markel, and that Lonzo was going to LA. We were very confident in that assessment.
I personally always think the worst stuff is going to happen. Just that's the way I'm wired. I'm pessimistic. I'm a worrier. I'm anxious. I just can't imagine. I can't imagine being so confident that no matter what your intel is, that the Lakers are going to take Lonzo at 2. I just, in my head, I would have just been so worried that the intel's wrong, or we're not like, so do you like,
well, it's one thing about that is that we couldn't get Lonzo to come to Boston for a workout. We had the number one pick in the draft for most of that whole process. So we just, and nobody was getting him to work out. So that was one reason why we just believed the intel. Not only the common, everybody was talking about it for a long time, but that was just, we had a very strong belief in that. So, there was a story that came out this week, though, about Jason going to Phoenix. Jason was never going to end up in Phoenix, even if he didn't come in for that second workout with us days before the draft in Boston. We were still going to take Jason Tatum.
Yeah, that was the fun. That was the thing about that story. It really beat up the Suns for not taking Jason Tatum. And I was like, well, I mean, that's clearly the workout process there that was described in that story was very poor. But they didn't have a chance to take Jason Tatum unless they were going to trade up somehow.
Well, but not only that, we thought that Brad Stevens and I had flown cross country to see Josh Jackson in a workout in Sacramento, and he didn't show. They called us when we landed and said, he's not going to make the workout. We thought that was Phoenix that had done that, that prevented him from doing the workout. So, listen, in Phoenix, you got the head coach is not there any longer. The general manager is not there any longer. Everybody has their own versions of how drafts would have gone. Anyway, it's good that we have Jason, and it's good that, there's stories coming out about him and how everybody else would have got him.
Have we not hit something on The Last Dance that we were supposed to talk? Have we not hit any memory, any part of the documentary you really wanted to talk about?
We've talked about way too much, Zach.
All your pain yeah, and suffering.
We can finally put this to bed, and I'll be able to sleep again.
I hope that I see you at an NBA game sometime in the not too distant future. I don't even know how to sign off with people in the league anymore. This is a very weird and strange time, but I wish your family safety and health. And I hope we look back on this at some point as this weird anomalous thing, and we're all at NBA games again. I don't know when that will happen, but stay healthy.
All right. You too, Zach. Thanks. It's good we finally got together.